Welcome, everybody. It is 1 p.m. Eastern, so we are going to get started today with our webinar. I'm going to get started with some housekeeping rules for today while we are in Zoom. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Clueinn for those not able to join us live. The Clueinn training page that brought you here today offers the slides available for download under Download Training Materials. Please use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical problems during today's training. We will have two Q&A breaks, the first about halfway through the training, with the second at the end of all of our training modules today. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form, which is also available on the Clueinn training page that brought you here today. Once you complete that form and click a box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be emailed to you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Cluin. Some background on the ITRC. The ITRC is the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council and is a program of the Environmental Council of the States, also known as ECOS. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website where you can learn more about how to become an active member and the teams available for registration. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask you to review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific product. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I would like to formally welcome everybody to today's training, Contaminants of Emerging Concern Identification Framework, which is an introduction to the ITRC online resources produced in 2023 of the same name. On slide number five, I have the pleasure of introducing our trainers joining us today. All of our trainers not only served as members of the CEC original team, but also have volunteered to support this training offered today. I'd like to just extend a big thank you to all of them for their continuous support and in the team in this training course. So with that, I'd like to first hand it off to Kim Nimmer from the Orange Water and Sewer Authority to get us started today.
All right. Great. Thank you, Devin. And good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, depending on where you are. My name is Kim Nimmer, and I'm pleased to be with you today. I will lay the foundation for my co-presenters by providing an overview of the documents that the CEC team has produced and that are available on the ITRC website. This graphic summarizes the Contaminants of Emerging Concern, or CEC framework, and the documents developed by ITRC, and will serve as a navigational tool during our presentation today. The white paper provides a summary of the issue and why it is important to consider CECs in the environment. The white paper was developed to be used by management level staff as it covers the overall approach and identifies potential challenges with developing a CEC program. More specifically, the white paper addresses factors that may influence a state's ability to address CECs, current CEC programs and approaches, and a new framework for identifying and monitoring CECs. The ITRC CEC team also developed a series of four fact sheets. The fact sheet addressing monitoring programs highlights which existing monitoring programs have data available on CECs in the environment or that could be used as a template to develop a monitoring program to gather more data on CECs. The fact sheet for the identification of key variables examines the questions, how do I evaluate or understand data on the CEC's occurrence, exposure, and potential to cause harm? What information would be needed to start making decisions on prioritizing chemicals detected in the environment? Key variables to consider when evaluating potential toxicity and exposure, schemes for interpreting variable information, and a case study is also considered. The Identification of Analytical Methods fact sheet presents information on how to identify and, if possible, quantify CECs in the environment, especially if there are no known analytical methods to use. Individual chemical compound analysis, analytical methods for chemical classes, methods for biological contaminants, and analysis of particulates. And the Risk Perception and Communications fact sheet considers how to communicate information on CECs to the public and stakeholders in a timely fashion. Risk communication basics, risk communication considerations and challenges specific to CECs, and it also covers some valuable lessons learned. And lastly, it should be noted that the fact sheets are not intended to be used as a flowchart or in a linear process. The fact sheets provide different information that can be used as part of a CEC program and should be referred to as needed and not in any particular order. All right. So the ITRC CEC team developed its CEC definition as follows. CECs are substances and microorganisms, including physical, chemical, biological, or radiological materials known or anticipated in the environment that may pose newly identified risks to human health or the environment. When considering the overall scope of what the framework would address, the team evaluated the three components of the CEC term and thought about which elements of contaminants, emergence, and concern would be emphasized. First, the term contaminants was originally thought to be synonymous with chemicals, and the team's name was going to be chemicals of emerging concern. However, the team decided to use the term contaminants to be in alignment with the definition in the bipartisan infrastructure law, especially considering the revolving funds provisions, which will be discussed further in the next slide. This alignment and terminology also allows for the inclusion of physical, radiological, or biological sourced issues. Next, the term emerging is somewhat subjective, and there was much debate amongst the team as to what is emerging versus what has already emerged. And along these lines, we'll address known unknowns and unknown unknowns, etc., later in the training. And lastly, the term concern focuses on human and environmental health risks as informed by the potential for exposure, potential hazards, and fate and transport properties. The ITRC CEC framework is intended to be a technical document, and its key variable decision tree leverages technical parameters to aid decision making. As mentioned in the last slide, the CEC team's definition aligns with the language provided in the US EPA memorandum titled Implementation of the Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Provisions of the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, or Bill, dated March 8, 2022, that provides guidance for obtaining funding to address CECs. It was purposely chosen because of the funding available to states through this new federal law. And note that even though the definition includes physical, chemical, biological, and radiological materials, the focus of these guidance materials is on chemical contaminants. Biologicals and radiologicals are not included. However, biologicals are the focus of ITRC's bio-CEC team that is currently active and which plans to publish guidance in 2025. So we're back to the framework slide, which we will use throughout the training as a transition between the white paper and the different fact sheets. We're going to start with the focus on the white paper that was developed by the CEC team. So let's start with considering why a CEC framework is needed. Regulatory agencies and the regulated community continue to be challenged by the ability to identify and address chemicals of emerging concern Even as the science of chemical testing advances and new information on chemical exposures and potential toxicity develops. The emergence of chemicals discovered during widespread monitoring with little or no toxicological data to put the risk and what does this mean into context will likely continue. Working to identify and address CECs presents new and diverse challenges to states and regulatory agencies. In addition to insufficient data and staff expertise to characterize and address CECs, many states do not have CEC monitoring programs established to start collecting the data needed. Another challenge is presented by the fact that validated laboratory analytical methods have not been developed for the thousands of CECs that are or may be present in different environmental media. Finally, information and a framework are needed to help agencies evaluate and prioritize CECs and to provide assistance with the challenging task of communicating with the public and other stakeholders about the risk of CECs when there are so many unknowns. So trying to anticipate and or identify chemicals that may emerge as contaminants of concern in the future and in the time frame demanded by the public can create a new and different set of challenges. In ITRC's CEC white paper and the four associated fact sheets, we provide a framework for a process to identify, evaluate, and respond to contaminants of emerging concern. The process is based on approaches used by other regulatory agencies, is peer-reviewed, and allows for a stepwise process that can be tailored by individual regulatory agencies to fit their specific needs and requirements, including their unique situations such as political and organizational structures, environment, and resource availability, including funding capacity. In the end, states are likely to be faced with the potential need to identify and address hundreds of chemicals present in the environment. Through the process developed by ITRC's CEC team, states can effectively and efficiently determine which chemicals should be a priority based on the available toxicological and analytical data. The United States Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA, was most recently updated in 2016, and it requires the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to maintain a database that identifies approximately 80,000 chemicals that are considered to be active in the environment, excluding non-chemical CECs such as radiologicals, biologicals, and microplastics. Current state regulatory actions commonly focus on a limited set of chemicals in the hundreds compared to the thousands of chemicals currently produced, imported, or used in manufacturing. In addition, there's limited exposure, toxicity, and fate and transport data for most of these chemicals. For example, the US EPA and states have developed scientific positions on human health effects for only several hundred compounds. This lack of information makes it difficult to track and eventually regulate these chemicals to protect human health and the environment. Given these conditions, it is understandable that addressing the other chemicals potentially present in the environment can be a significant challenge for state regulatory agencies from both a data and resource availability position. This framework was designed to provide our primary audience of state government leadership with guidance regarding how to identify and prioritize emerging contaminants to timely incorporate regulation and prevent negative impacts to human health and the environment. The framework is intended to be useful whether or not a state has a CEC program. The four fact sheets were developed from the key concepts determined by the CEC team to be vital to the structure of a CEC program. To support this process, the white paper and the four associated fact sheets provide a framework that state environmental or health agencies can use to develop a CEC program. Overall, understanding and monitoring CECs can provide the information necessary to allow states to take corrective and regulatory action, ultimately safeguarding public health and the environment. So this graph is from a paper that presents a bibliometric analysis of peer-reviewed scientific literature on emerging contaminants published from 2000 through 2019. The definition of emerging contaminants used in this study was broader than ITRC's CEC definition. The study included naturally occurring, manufactured or man-made chemicals or materials found in the environment whose toxicity or persistence is likely to significantly affect the metabolism of a living being. The study and graph are illustrative of the rapidly increasing awareness, interest, and scientific study of emerging compounds. The last 5 years of this study, from 2015 through 2019, show a substantial increase in journal publications, more than doubling from around 400 to approximately 1,000 publications on CEC research annually. The United States, China, the United States, China, Spain, Italy, and Canada were the top five most productive countries in terms of the number of published works. According to the frequency of author keywords, the main research topic addressed by the researchers was the occurrence of pharmaceuticals and personal care products in wastewater. In addition to scientific publications, the increasing regulations and the development of CEC programs reflect a growing interest in CECs. So now we're going to shift from the white paper to the four CEC fact sheets. We'll first take a look at the CEC monitoring programs fact sheet, which presents existing monitoring programs that may have available data on CECs in the environment, or that may be used as a template to develop a monitoring program to gather more data on CECs. I'd like to welcome Carol Stein, EPA Project Manager Emeritus, to take a look at the CEC monitoring programs fact sheet. Carol?
Thank you, Kim. Okay, so I'm now going to discuss the CEC monitoring programs fact sheet. It presents information on existing monitoring programs that can be used as examples for developing your own monitoring program. Okay. Let's see. I am clicking and nothing's happening. Sorry, let me try it again. Oops.
Carol, if you want to just move your mouse around, I don't see it yet. So that it's on the perfect right now. Perfect. You should be able to click.
Okay, I'll do it this way. Great. Okay. Okay, the CEC monitoring program's fact sheet consists of two separate components, an Excel table and an instructional narrative on how to use the Excel table. Okay, so a portion of the Excel table has been enlarged for this slide. The table shows representative programs from state, federal, local, international, and other organizations. Each row of the table is dedicated to a specific organization that has a monitoring program in place. If an organization has several monitoring programs for different environmental media, a separate line is dedicated to each of these programs. If you want to learn more about how to use the table, please watch the demonstration video that goes into more detail about navigating this new tool. And the demonstration video is included online within the CEC framework document. All right, so here's a quick look at the 11 columns in the CEC monitoring program table and what each column contains. I'm going to keep it for a minute just so that you can take a look at the different media. Okay. Great. And there are 17 types of programs covered in the table. They include environmental media and health monitoring programs. The scope of the fact sheet includes just the programs that are noted here. And these programs can be found with a drop-down menu on column D of the table. And the corresponding environmental media can be found on column F. Okay. I don't know if you wanted to see on if you had enough time to look. We could later on, if you wanted to take another chance to look at the programs, we could show it later on during the Q&A. Okay, But please note that the fact sheet does not include the types of programs listed on this slide because the types of programs were either they were either outside the scope of the CEC team's mission or outside the scope of the information collected for this fact sheet. Okay, and I'll leave it for a couple of seconds so that you can look at the items that are not covered in the fact sheet. Please keep in mind that there are a few limitations to the fact sheet and table. This is because the CEC selection criteria for establishing CEC monitoring programs are not universally applied to all federal and state CEC monitoring programs. For example, some states or other organizations no longer consider certain contaminants to be CEC because they already have regulations in place for these contaminants. In these cases, the organization already may have a monitoring program for these contaminants, but the program is not included on this table because the organization no longer considers the contaminant to be a CEC. Second, a state or other organization might not identify a specific contaminant for monitoring under its CEC program because the contaminant is not considered to be a key variable of concern within the jurisdiction of that organization. Okay. We encourage you to visit the ITRC CEC framework document online to view the monitoring program's fact sheet and the tutorial on how to use the fact sheet. We hope this will provide you with useful information for formulating your own CEC monitoring program. Also, please note that drinking water data are normally more available than other monitoring media for exposure point protection. Finally, please note that high priority CEC, such as PFAS and monitoring media, are more likely to lead into the development of a CEC monitoring program. Okay, now we're going to transition to learning about the key variables fact sheet. I would like to welcome Jose Zambrana of EPA's Office of Research and Development, who will be discussing key variables. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carol, and good morning and good afternoon. I am Jose Zambrana, as Carol said, and I'm with the US EPA Office of Research and Development. A quick disclaimer, the views that I present are my own, not those of the EPA, and for my participation from EPA onto this ITRC team, which was truly a great experience. And I'm honored to be among the trainers today and to share with you about this part of the guidance document, the key variables fact sheet. So let's go ahead and launch into it. So the key variables fact sheet really addresses the question of how my occurrence, toxicity and persistence of a known or suspected CEC be evaluated. This part of the fact sheet, the guidance document, this fact sheet presents a couple of key things. First, it has a logical flow chart for how to evaluate a CEC, and it's based upon the risk paradigm. So hopefully the elements of it will look like something you've seen before, very familiar. You really want to ask ourselves what variables are critical when we're addressing a CEC. The flowchart was developed by the key variables team, and it's in the fact sheet to illustrate a very intentional approach for CEC evaluation. Those sort of variables that are chosen with regards to evaluating risk based on, of course, exposure potential and toxicity. With regard to key criteria, we want to know what information resources are available out there that we can draw upon to inform these different criteria. Good scientific information is important and can be used to reduce uncertainty and improve evaluation of risk. So as you maybe as a decision maker or program manager having to deal with the CEC, as you move through the process of evaluating a CEC, it's really good to continue to ask whether the available information for the task at hand is sufficient per your own program's requirements. And that's going to be an important theme today as we go through this. What we present should always be contextualized with the program that you're overseeing and the particular requirements of your program. And then some information that's also available in the fact sheet is about tools for prioritizing and interpreting CEC data. So again, why are we doing all of this? Why evaluate key variables in particular? And we've heard Kim talk about sort of the context here that we're dealing with contaminants, we're dealing with thousands of chemicals that are released and identified in the environment. We're dealing with the concern over those contaminants, and that concern emerges when substances used in the built environment are released through activities like production, use, or disposal and end up in the environment. It is challenging to determine which of those needs to be addressed. So a particular event may lead to more attention. Maybe we get the call in the middle of the night that something has happened and there's a chemical and no one knows what it is or what to do, and we have to figure it out right away. And public concern can grow over time, particularly with new information as it becomes available about a particular substance. So for the present CEC framework, we are focusing primarily on chemicals that can be measured in the environment and for which there are direct effects to humans and ecological endpoints. One thing that the guidance doesn't deal with is indirect effects, say like something that can cause there to be loss of ozone in the atmosphere and then all the problems that happen there. So really dealing with direct effects to human and ecological endpoints. So there's this big flow chart in the guidance document, and in particular in this fact sheet. We are going to be looking at three criteria. They are exposure and occurrence, toxicity, and fate and transport or chemical behavior. And one of the things that is important is that we always ask ourselves, is the data we have sufficient? Does the data we have suggest a concern? It's also important to think about degradation products and cross-media kinds of concerns. Within the context of this flowchart, we ask ourselves, where is the CEC occurring? Drinking water resources can be very sensitive because they're high risk for human exposure if they're being used for drinking. We want to ask ourselves, what are the health effects of the CEC? How much information do we have available about that? Other key variables that come into place are persistence, bioaccumulation, and mobility, how the CEC behaves in the environment. So the flowchart is meant to help you determine how a CEC might be characterized and prioritized. And our goal is to provide a framework so that you can put it into one of three bins: a low priority, medium priority, and a high priority. And we'll talk a little bit more about what those mean. So the intent of prioritization is to determine next steps. What do you have to do next for evaluating and coming up with the decision? So we believe that designating a CEC as low, medium, or high priority helps you do this. And those designations are based on occurrence, toxicity, exposure risk, and physical chemical properties. So let's look at this chart. Let's start with low priority. As you can see, a CEC that has a low priority may not call for any kind of monitoring, doesn't suggest any significant concern. And it's a kind of thing where you would be open to new information that could change the prioritization. So sort of a passive wait and see approach. Let's skip for a moment to high priority. For high priority, It calls for there to be expanding monitoring because of a widespread or significant concern. And additional risk characterization is going to be conducted and even potential rulemaking. Now let's go to medium. Medium doesn't necessarily mean that it's halfway between low and high. It's not in the middle, so to speak. Medium priority for what we're presenting means that additional information is needed. We need to be active about it so that you can find that information to do risk characterization and then take the information and reprioritize the medium into low or high. That's kind of a holding area where more information is needed to then put it into the low or the high. What's really important in working through this process together is that professional judgment is needed to weigh different factors. There can be complications like compound classes, mixtures can emerge. New data always suggests a reevaluation, sort of triggering a thought process that has you go through it again, make sure that you're on target. And as you can see from these arrows, priority levels can be shifted due to reevaluation, and reevaluation may be needed periodically. So let's start with the first. We begin with occurrence and exposure. And we start there because if we don't have an exposure, then the concern is significantly goes down. But if we have exposure, then that kind of drives what we need to do next. So where is the CEC found? We're going to ask ourselves different questions as part of this flowchart process and see what information we have. So, for example, is the CEC identified in groundwater or surface water that's being used as a drinking water resource? Again, if it's used as drinking water resource, it's going to be a priority because of direct exposure from ingestion. So groundwater and surface water, we often begin there, but circumstances can vary. For example, occurrence could be in soil where there are sensitive populations, such as children, that can be affected and that need to be considered. CEC may be a bioaccumulative, and so looking at fish may be a particular concern for your program. Or CEC in consumer products can lead to a whole variety of kinds of exposure scenarios. Ecological exposures raise similar questions. So we're always thinking of both human and ecological endpoints. Ecological exposures raise questions about mobility, sensitive species, concerns for biodiversity. One thing to also mention is that, is there a new pathway or is there a concern because a new pathway for exposure or a new medium is at play, something that hasn't been considered before? And that's what often speaks to the emerging part of a CEC. After the occurrence, we go to toxicity, and we're looking at effects, human health-based or ecological. So for many CECs, there is information about chemical characteristics, but oftentimes, particularly for something that's emerging, that's new, very little information on toxicity, or the toxicity data that's out there is very limited, or it's of a type that's not normally used for federal or state risk assessments. As always, the data needs to be vetted to determine whether it can provide an adequate assessment of human health or ecological risk and can be used to develop toxicity values. It's always important in order to provide clarity and transparency to acknowledge your assumptions, acknowledge our assumptions, and acknowledge uncertainties. We always critically ask ourselves, are the effects significant? Are there new exposure routes to assess toxicity? And this, again, is often a key factor with CEC, is a new exposure route. Okay, and then the third criteria, you can see we're kind of making our way down this flowchart, which is too big to show it. I'm in detail, but kind of highlighting little parts here. So the third criteria, and we'll dive in with the case study to come. But the third criteria is the physical chemical properties. And these are properties that inform fate and transport and chemical behavior. So key questions such as, does the CEC persist in the environment? What media are affected? Air, water, soil, or a combination? Fresh water or marine environment? Whether a CEC bioaccumulates through the food chain can be very important. Are there other properties that could be of concern, such as other products that can come up through degradation? Information out there could be empirical, it could be estimated, and this will frame how it's considered. There are also unique characteristics that can fall into this particular category, like foaming characteristics or unique fate and transport properties, amphiphilic compounds with polar and nonpolar regions can aggregate in water. All of these kinds of things could affect properties, its behavior, and thus the level of concern and response needed. Okay, so this has just been an overview of this fact sheet, key variables. We've discussed a number of things, a flowchart for considering key variables to inform prioritizing CEC. Again, our goal is to bin it into low, medium, or high. Some key questions that need to be considered on occurrence, toxicology, and physical chemical properties that inform fate and transport and chemical behavior. Some other things I want to mention about the fact sheet that are there are different kinds of resources. One, there's resources for where to look for toxicity information, resources on where to find data on fate and transport, or resources to do some kind of estimation of those values. Always, there are key questions presented to help you think through data sufficiency and how to evaluate that with respect to your program. We also have some resources on interpreting information on variables. And we don't present one perspective on interpreting, like if you have all these factors, you know, this is how you should address it. That's going to be depend on your professional judgment and on the program that you're a part of. But we do have some examples and frameworks for how other organizations and folks have put together all this information and how they interpret it. And then finally, there's a case study to help make this more real. And that's something that we're going to be going through together as well. Okay. Well, let's launch into that case study, and we're going to try to make this a little interactive to the degree that we can. So feel free to participate when invited to do so. So we're going to run through the case study that's in the fact sheet, and the purpose is to use a hypothetical scenario that we're going to present and then think through how we would go through the flowchart together and see where we land. So I'm going to present a hypothetical. This isn't a real world. This is just a hypothetical for the purposes of thinking through this case study. Okay, so here we go. So we're going to consider a potential CEC, which was initially detected first as a tentatively identified compound and then confirmed with the standard. Here's what we know about the conceptual site model concerning where the CEC was found. It was found in a property well, and the well is being used as a drinking water resource at a site. Using a reference standard, we have an identified chemical. The long name is there. It's also considered perchlorobenzotrifluoride. It was also detected in wastewater during a full scan using GC mass spec. And later on, you're going to hear a lot more information about the whole realm of analyzing for CECs. But for now, this is part of our hypothetical scenario. This particular chemical is not listed in any federal or state's list of chemicals that are regularly monitored or analyzed in environmental media. But It is known as one of several compounds in a chemical mixture being used as a solvent substitute for xylene. And I should say this is at an industrial property. So we're looking at an industrial property. Additional monthly testing of four wastewater and four drinking water wells of samples for 3 consecutive months was conducted. These monitoring events included appropriate quality control processes by the same lab that initially detected and identified the CEC. So this really speaks to having sufficient data of sufficient quantity and quality to make an assessment of the occurrence criteria. Okay, so that's the scenario. We have this case, and what we want to is ask you, what would you do? So what if this was your situation, what additional information would you seek to try to figure out what to do next? So why don't you go ahead, put in some answers as to what information would you want to seek about this situation? I think what's going to happen is, I think, Devin, is once we close it, then maybe I'll be able to see some of the answers.
Gonna give about 10 more seconds here for
We'll
some
give people
responses.
10 more seconds. Okay. Sounds perfect. Okay.
All right. Jose, can you see any of those responses? If not, I can read some out.
I can't. Why don't you go ahead and read them, please, Devin?
Okay. So, in no particular order, we've got chemical properties, toxicity, industrial processes occurring on site, state and transport studies published, tox values, contaminants already tested for, plume migration off site towards any other receptors, any discharges to surface water, who would be exposed, what the MSDS says about exposure. And then just to conclude would be human risk and identifying who that would be again.
Superb. Okay. Unsurprisingly, a very smart audience of people who have maybe been in these kinds of situations before. Yeah, so all good things in terms of what is needed to follow up. So let's say that you did some follow-up. And here's what additional information was found. So again, part of our hypothetical. So the wastewater data and the company's process and safety information indicate the presence of the CEC in wastewater comes from a waste stream of the industrial process used at the site. We find out that the CEC is a component of a solvent and an intermediate in pesticide production. We find out that the CEC was detected in all but one sample from the drinking water well, and that indicates groundwater contamination. The workers at the site are drinking the water, therefore creating a direct exposure route. The extent of contamination on site and off site is not known, requires further investigation. Soil and ambient air concentrations of the potential CEC are not known and require further investigation. Volatilization from groundwater to indoor air pathways requires evaluation. We do find out the potential CEC is a solvent that's used in some caulks, paints, and coatings and found in some fabric stain removers. It's possible, thus, that the chemical could migrate into indoor air. And further evaluation of its hazard and physical chemical properties and presence in other media, soil and air, and at other sites would be required. Okay, so we have some information and we have a lot of things we don't know. We also learn from the European Chemical Agency that this chemical is used in consumer products such as coatings, inks and toners, it's used as a manufacturer in other chemicals, and machines and vehicles, plastic products and mineral products. It's used in R&D and as an intermediate step in manufacturing other substances. And release can occur from industrial use or may occur from indoor or outdoor use as a processing aid. Okay. So, there's that little part there. So let's go to our flowchart. Okay. Again, this is our attempt to try to give a little zoom in. So in the flowchart, we have here, we're doing occurrence criteria, and we have a number of questions that we're asking ourselves. These questions aren't meant to be like, if you have like a yes and two no's, or two yeses and a no, or all yeses, that it would define what to do. These are meant to questions that are important for reflecting upon and getting some answers to help inform whether you have sufficient data to answer them and whether you have enough data to proceed to evaluating toxicity. In cases where you really lack data, you would clearly then need to do some monitoring and follow up to get that data before doing further evaluation. So we would ask ourselves, so let's look at this first question. Has the CEC been identified in groundwater or surface water? And I think you all know that, okay, groundwater, we saw it. Surface water, we did not see that. Next question. Has the CEC been identified in multiple media or media with sensitive receptors? And we have some information on that. Soil, unknown. Ambient air, unknown. Indoor air, unknown. But wastewater, yes, we did see that detection. And the third question, has a previously identified CEC been identified in a new medium because of a new pathway? And we didn't see anything about that. So as we always said, we have to ask ourselves, is the data we have sufficient? And that's really important. So for occurrence data, this question seeks to answer analytical methods in terms of their being valid, data sufficiency, reproducibility, and other data relevant issues. And there's a box in the fact sheet, box one, that has these questions. By answering the questions asked at the beginning of the CEC variables flowchart, we can conclude that there is sufficient evidence of the presence of the potential CEC in the environment, because we have the wastewater and the drinking water detections. So again, if the data is not good enough, we need to collect. If it is good enough, then we can make some decisions. If we see no exposures at all, then we could theoretically put it into the low priority CEC. If we said, you know what, no one's being exposed at all, so we don't see a concern, you could put it in that bin and be done. If there are concerns and your data is good enough, then you can proceed to the next step and continue with the evaluation. So for this case study, I would propose to you that occurrence data is sufficient and indicative of a need to continue. It's unlikely that based on what we talked about, they would put it into the low priority category and be done with it, but rather that we should continue with our evaluation. Okay, let's talk about toxicity. So we do our due diligence and look up information on this chemical, and what do we find? So we see that the potential CEC has some available oral and inhalation toxicity values that are in the table. We have a chronic reference dose for oral and RFD, a cancer slope factor for inhalation, a chronic reference concentration, RFC for inhalation, and an inhalation unit risk factor from Cal-EPA. We also have some information from Cal-EPA that exposures can occur by passing from mother to the baby during pregnancy, exposure through inhalation and skin contact, and that it's a likely human carcinogen. From ECHA, we find out that it's suspected of causing cancer, damaging fertility of an unborn child, causing serious eye irritation, and can cause allergic skin reaction or skin irritation. And from ECHA, we also find out that it's toxic to aquatic life with long-lasting effects and can be a hazard also to terrestrial organisms. Note that some of the information, the cancer slope factor and all that, is for inhalation. So just a note, because we're going to come back to that. Okay, so now let's go to this part of the flowchart. So again, we're just going to ask ourselves some key questions and see what we got. So first question, does the CEC pose human and or ecological health effects of concern? And I think we have a clear yes there. Second question, does CEC pose toxicity at lower levels than previously known? Which is often what happens with some CEC. In this case, we don't know. Does the CEC pose toxicity via exposure routes not previously identified? And maybe, based on some of the discussions that, based on some of the information that we have. Okay, we ask ourselves, is the data that we have sufficient value to go to the next step? We do have some gaps here. So we have non-cancer endpoints are not known. Soil, and ambient air would need to be characterized. Extrapolating from inhalation to oral toxicity would be needed, because we have oral ingestion, but we have inhalation information. And data on additional ecological endpoints to fish and aquatic species would be helpful. So the data we have, I would propose, is of sufficient quality. Again, we have what we have, but what we have is sufficient for us to say, you know, this is good and let's continue moving through our evaluation, rather than stopping and trying to collect everything. Always ask ourselves data sufficiency questions. If the data really is bad and really is lacking, obviously, then we would need it in order to keep going. If we have data that is of some sufficiency, then we can continue with the evaluation. It's also important that preliminary risk characterization is possible here based on the information. Detective of potential CEC levels in groundwater can be evaluated against cancer-based drinking water screening level or other kinds of criterion. So we propose the toxicity data is sufficient and indicative enough of a need to continue. So now we can propose to go to step three. So physical chemical properties. And again, this is meant to inform our evaluation. We have some information from our due diligence that's presented there. We have some information on melting point, boiling point, solubility. It's octanol water partition coefficient. But we also have a lot of gaps as well. So completion of the information gaps will inform fate and transport, persistence, bioaccumulation, and mobility that we might not have here. Understanding fate and transport would lead to better understanding of all potential exposure pathways and consequences, and consequently, the risk to sensitive receptors. So based on what we have, it'd be beneficial to identify or estimate other fate and transport properties. This might be the Henry's law, constant, other information to inform exposures because of volatility, persistence, half-life, bioaccumulation, biomagnification. And validation of these factors would be needed to ensure that our conclusions are correct. So this is one of those things where professional judgment is important. This information would be useful, but we do have some critical data from our occurrence and our toxicity evaluations that can really help us move forward. But you can see the different questions that are there that that you would ask yourself to help you make this evaluation. Okay. So now we're kind of at the end. So again, based on what we've discussed and maybe requirements of your program, what would you do? Would you prioritize this chemical as low, as a medium, or as a high? You can only choose one, so we'll give you a few more seconds to make your choice. And we'll go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, Devin. Okay, we have results. What do we got here? Hey, We got a one low, we got 42 out of 64 mediums, and 21 out of 64 high. Okay. That's very informative. Thank you for doing that. So let's talk about that. So we always consider data sufficiency based on your program requirements. If your data is lacking and completely insufficient, you need to collect it and reassess. If your data is good, we could classify it as a medium if we think that there's a need for additional information, meaning we can't rule out high, or we might believe based on the information that it goes right into high. And again, some of that is going to be professional judgment and based on your program's requirements. So I was going to say drum roll, but again, this is not meant to say that this is the right answer. This is meant to help us step through and think where we might land. So based on this information, I would propose that a medium would be a reasonable place. But again, this does not negate that based on some of the information in your program, it might go into high. But putting it in medium identifies that you would need some more information to figure out whether we need to, whether it's a widespread concern, whether it's a significant concern, whether there's expanded monitoring needed, the degree of additional risk characterization that's needed, and the potential for rulemaking. And this one, it was found in drinking water, exposure pathway of concern, hazardous substance, carcinogenic, irritant, suspected reproductive toxicant, volatile, soluble in water, but occurrence in other media, soil and air, non-cancer effects, developmental impacts could be further characterized, and information about indoor air would be needed as well. Okay. We're getting to our little wrap-up here. So I hope that you found that important or valuable. When it goes into medium, you collect more information so that you could eventually decide whether it goes into low or high. But again, if you decided that is high, then you would proceed accordingly. One quick note, there's going to be a further presentation about risk communication. But just to highlight here that we have information about communicating when we do have a medium priority, and we have some sort of details about that that focus on what you do with an internal audience, meaning and within your organization, how in a medium priority circumstance you would need to advocate for expanded data collection, recommendations, and communication plans, particularly if you're having to communicate to susceptible subpopulations. These are sort of active things you can do, or how you can promote action from your organization. There's the whole external audience and how you communicate known risk, particularly to impacted subgroups, and where there might be proximity questions, lifestyle questions, things like that could affect risk. There's always a need to reduce outrage in certain circumstances, and we'll talk more about that. But how you plan for communicating internally to decision makers so they can get information and take steps to and protect impacted populations, and then how you can continue to communicate with the public with honesty, with transparency, and of course, with empathy. Okay, so that brings us to the end of our key variables fact sheet and the case study. Hope it was informative, and I think this opens the door. I'm sure there are a bunch of questions now that we've been through that. So,
All right, thank you, Jose, and thank you to our first two speakers as well, Carol and Kim. As Jose mentioned, this will be our first Q&A portion of the training. We again will have one more at the end of our modules today. So you're welcome to put questions into the Q&A pod at any time, and our trainers, we will get to those during these two Q&A sessions. So just a quick reminder before we jump into the Q&A, if you are interested in a certificate of completion for this course, they are available by completing the feedback form, which is linked on the training page that brought you to the course today. And then once we leave the webinar, you will be brought immediately to that page as well. All right, so with that, I will look to the Q&A pod here and read these questions out loud for our trainers to answer. So, our first question: if there is a known contaminant that is of unknown toxicity that is exposing workers through drinking water, shouldn't there be an immediate response, such as providing clean water via water bottles until no more data can be collected on risk?
Yeah, thanks for that question, and I invite others who might wanna jump in. So, as I sort of mentioned, the goal here is to help you think through the critical questions in order to help you develop a response that makes sense for you and your program. So, if there's if that might be how your program might handle the situation, then that's what you would do. At least then, having going through the flow chart, it would help you have the information about what you've thought through, what you have, what you don't have, to inform exactly how you're doing those actions and how you're sort of planning for the follow-up. But that would be my answer to that. I don't know if any of my colleagues have any other suggestions for that. I think that's what we have for now, Demon, on that one.
All right, thank you, trainers. Our next question: if a long existing chemical in the environment is known, but the toxicity is unknown, can this chemical be later categorized as a CEC if the toxicity is eventually distinguished?
Thanks for that question. Yeah, so that is typically sort of, this is a big thing why ITRC like did this whole thing on CEC, because contaminants emerge, issues emerge, and concerns emerge. And one of the things that stimulates that is new information that we didn't have before. New information that could be of concern exactly does that. So I would definitely say a yes to that.
All right, thank you, Jose. Are PFAS considered CECs?
Maybe sometimes we get this question, and I could, it's something that, around a few drinks and stuff, a lot of us on our team talked about, like, and I would don't have a clear answer. I would as to some would say that it's being dealt with, so maybe it's not quite a CEC because we have more information, but there are so many thousands of PFAS, so it would maybe depend very much on exactly which one you're looking at. But that's just my jumping in there. I don't know if any of my other colleagues want to speak to the discussions we've had a lot about PFAS and CEC.
I'll chime in briefly, Jose. I'm sorry, Carol. I won't be long. But I support what Jose just said. I mean, we're, I think, over 10,000, PFAS at this point, and still learning a lot. So I think you could certainly argue that many out there, and those that we don't yet know about, could arguably be considered CECs, or we may know them, but don't understand fully the toxicity. So it's kind of a chapter that's still being written. I'm sorry, Carol, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I just was going to say that the monitoring programs table that I spoke about, it mentions a number of states that have CEC monitoring programs. So for the purpose of the document that we produced, we considered CECs to be I'm sorry, considered PFAS to be CECs. Thank
Thank
you.
you, Carol.
All right, thank you, trainers. So that concludes our first round of Q&A. Again, we will have one more opportunity at the end of our modules today to verbally answer some more questions from the audience. So with that, I will be passing it off to Farouk Ahmad from California DTSC.
Okay, let's see.
All right.
I can get control. Okay, here we go. Okay, so We're now at the analytical methods fact sheet. And the focus of this fact sheet is to primarily to identify any unknown CC and then potentially quantify it in environmental media. So let me remind you why you're here. If you remember Dr. Zambrano's flowchart in the key variables fact sheet presentation, it started off with a box asking you, do you have a validated analytical method for this particular CEC, or is the identity of the CEC known? So if you don't, then that would bump you off into this fact sheet, which is dealing with compounds which previously have not been analyzed or identified or quantified in environmental media. So this fact sheet consists of four different sections. The first section deals with individual chemical compound analysis. There are other sections on chemical class, methods for biological contaminants, and also the analysis of particulates. The focus of this particular training is going to be on individual chemical compound analysis, and we will do that with two illustrative examples. The first case study deals with the same compound that Dr. Zambrano mentioned in his case study, which was identified as a TIC or tentatively identified compound. And the second one, or the second case study, will deal with a new compound that was not known at the time when it was identified. There are other resources in the fact sheet, and the fact sheet is basically an online document, so you can go look up the acronyms list or the glossary of analytical and technical terms, as well as, there are online resources at the end of each section. So I welcome you to go check some of those out. Just as a pref to pref preface this, the fact sheet was written for a technical audience. So essentially, people familiar with some analytical chemistry or maybe biotechnologists. However, there are these resources available from which you can sort of on-ramp onto some of the material presented here. Okay. So I just wanted to take a minute to talk about the CEC problem in general. And CECs typically is basically a diminishing uncertainty over time problem. So it's a transient problem where initially very little is known about the CEC. You're unaware, perhaps you see an effect in the environment or in public health, but you don't know what's causing it. So that at that point, that's a complete unknown unknown. And as you learn more about it, perhaps it's been isolated and identified. At that point, it's a known unknown. But perhaps it hasn't been showing up in environmental media before. So that's a known unknown. And then finally, once we've identified it and have developed an analytical method for it that's validated, at that point, it's a known known. So sort of that's the sort of the uncertainty arc, and it can be mapped onto this matrix of knowns and unknowns. It's an idea from decision science, and where you start off with the maximum amount of uncertainty and the unknown unknown quadrant at the bottom right, and then travel to the known known quadrant on the top left. Now, when we're talking about analytical methods, generally, as a practical matter, we follow the opposite direction of the arc. And the point of that is that we want to utilize all resources available to us to sort of move on to the next phase, to more exploratory phases. So we start off with known knowns. So if we encounter an unknown compound, we'll run our exhaustive validated target analysis on that sample and try to figure out if it can be found on a target analyte list in one of the existing methods. Now, if we can't find it, then we're sort of in the known unknown category, and perhaps it's a manufactured compound, but it has previously not been analyzed in environmental media. So at that point, you can go to things like historical information, materials used in a particular process, things of that nature, to come up with a suspect list from which you can start your analysis and try to identify that compound. So it's somewhat of an exploratory technique at this point, suspect screening. And then if you have no information whatsoever, you can't find it any kind of manufactured compound list, any kind of library for spectra, so on and so forth, then you sort of enter the realm of non-targeted analysis, which is an approach which has championed high-resolution mass spectrometry to at least determine the molecular mass of the compound. So the key message here is that you want to exhaust all established targeted analysis methods before moving on, and hence the reverse arc of this process. There are two case studies, as I mentioned, and the first case study is sort of sits between the first and second quadrant, between the known knowns and the known unknowns, because we ran a targeted analytical method like 8270C, which is for semi volatiles, and came up with a new peak, which was later identified as a TIC or a tentatively identified compound. And the second case study deals with a completely unknown compound, and hence we rely on, excuse me, a combination of toxicity testing, which is effect-directed analysis, and non-target analysis, which is high-resolution mass spectrometry. Now, both of these on the right two quadrants typically rely on high-resolution mass spectrometry as a sort of a first step. This slide tries to bring home the point that you know, reference materials are a key thing to identifying and quantifying any kind of compound in environmental media. So if you have both a stored spectrum for the compound as well as a calibration standard, you can then both identify it and quantify it. And that is the basis for a lot of the validated analytical methods. So that's called target screening or target analysis. If you don't have a calibration standard handy, but you still have a stored spectrum available in the library, you can still identify it and try to get hold of a standard to then try to quantify it. But that's sort of the known unknown quadrant that we talked about before. And then finally, we have non-target screening where we don't have any known spectrum, we don't have a calibration standard, and we have to rely sort of on a particular instrument, in this case, high-resolution mass spectrometry, to come up with a molecular ion mass. Okay, this brings us to our first case study, and it's essentially the same compound. I call it chlorotrifluorotoluene. And I'd like you to just ignore that for the thing on the right for the moment. And essentially, as the scenario mentioned, that an environmental sample was run by 8270C in full scan mode. So it's looking for different compounds. And it came up with, it's looking for different compounds, and it's also generating spectra from that sample as the different compounds get separated as chromatographic peaks. So it was identified, it was matched against the library of spectra for the target analyte list, and didn't match anything. At that point, in step two, you would go on and match it against the wider library, which is which comes with every GC-MS instrument, which is the Wiley-NIST library. It has about 1.2 million compounds, manufactured compounds per in its database, and it has spectra for those. So once you run it against that, you can get a tentative identified compound hit if your match criteria meets 85% or higher. So that's a US EPA criteria typically, and if it's that level, then we can consider it as a take or a suspect compound that we can then further explore. Once you've identified that compound, you can try and acquire the standard. In this case, trifluorotoluene is a precursor in a lot of different manufacturing processes as a starting point for a couple of different ones. So this compound is available from various chemical vendors, from others as well. And you can acquire it and simply run a calibration curve and get a response factor or a calibration curve and modify the targeted method for identifying and quantifying this compound, as long as your unknown peak matches this particular compound's standard peak. If there is not anything available through a chemical vendor, then you would go ahead and synthesize this compound. And this is a slightly pricier option, but it is available through specialty calibration standard companies. Usually they have a synthetic chemist or a department that will try and do that at a cost. So you might be wondering, well, that's a pretty straightforward process, right? We have this enormous library of 1.2 million compounds. Anytime we run an environmental sample and we come up with something that is not familiar, why not match it and then just get an idea of what it is? So the caveat here is that this is a GC-MS method. It's easy to develop reference analytical libraries that are platform independent. By platform independent, I mean like instrument independent in different labs, different research groups, and even relatively resistant to any kind of matrix effect. So you can use that reference library anywhere around the world to or on any instrument to as long as you're using the same ionization technique. So let's get into that a little bit more of why that works and why it doesn't work for everything. So here's GC-MS on the left and LC-MS on the right. And I just want to take a minute to talk about spectral libraries and ionization. So for GC-MS, the most common ionization technique that's used everywhere, including all the EPA targeted analytical methods, is electron ionization. The old name for it was electron impact ionization. It's done at a very high energy at 70 electron volts. It has a high ionization efficiency. What that means, if you look at the equation or the relationship at the bottom, is that it generates a lot of fragment ions from your target molecule. So essentially, it's breaking down your target molecule into as many pieces as it can be possibly broken. And that's a reliable fragmentation because of the energy used. And because of the fact that the analyte is in the gas phase with an inert gas. So this kind of process is very, very tolerant to matrix effects, and it's highly reproducible fragmentation on any instrument or platform. So if you look at it on the right on this curve, you're sort of at the far right end of the curve where you have high energy. And remember, all these fragments are charged particles or charged fragments. They're traveling through an electrical field, and hence they produce a relatively constant current. This is still on a log scale, but it's sort of within the order of magnitude, the current that's produced from electron impact ionization. So because of this, you have libraries that are completely platform independent, and they can be reliably used as reference spectral libraries. Now, on the other hand, with LC-MS uses a soft ionization technique. It's called electrospray ionization or ESI. And here, the challenge is that your target analyte is eluting with a lot of liquid solvent. And so the challenge is to separate your target analyte from all the solvent that surrounds it. And that process, the energy imparted onto your target analyte is a lot less. And because of that, you have a lower ionization efficiency. So typically, it will generate the mass ion peak of perhaps one or two more fragments through ESI. And I don't have a good graphic here, but essentially, it's nebulizing the liquids that's coming off the column. So it's making all these strong, small droplets. And as they flow through the ionizer, the sort of droplets get smaller and smaller until all the solvent has evaporated, and then your molecule is left behind in an ionized form. So as I said, you know, the energy used in ESI or imparted onto your target analyte is a lot less. Generally, you know, most compounds will ionize at 15 electron volts or less. And the ESI interface, the energy it imparts onto your target analyte is somewhere on this curve. And because of this, you know, it can change. The fragmentation is somewhat variable, and it's sensitive to things in your sample, so sensitive to matrix effects. And LC-MS libraries do exist, and a number of them are available for LC-MS analysis. However, you know, these have to be normalized using a calibration standard. So again, you come back to your calibration standard that you need to normalize it, to make sure that, you know, wherever the library was developed, the instrument, the data that's generated from that can be normalized to your particular instrument. So that's the challenge. And typically each research lab or each lab actually tries to develop its own spectral library for its particular instruments. Now, there's one type of mass spectrometer that gets around both of these, and that's called the high resolution mass spectrometer. And we'll get into how that works in the next slide. So a high resolution mass spectrometer is, as the name implies, it has high resolution, meaning that it can separate, when you look at the mass spectrum, it can have independent peaks right next to each other for for small changes in mass. Here on the bottom, I'm showing sort of a table for monoisotopic mass, meaning the most abundant stable isotope for carbon, for hydrogen, for nitrogen, and oxygen. So I'm not showing N15 or anything like that. It's just these most abundant stable isotope. So these all have an accurate mass up to the, you know, sixth or seventh decimal place. And the way an HRMS works is that, you know, those decimal places can help you decipher what exactly that compound is. Now, when I went to graduate school, you know, most mass spectrometers, what we used typically were quadrupole. So we had unit resolution. So if we saw a mass ion peak that corresponded to 60, we wouldn't be able to tell the difference between these four different compounds. But now with accurate mass determination using high resolution mass spectrometry, we can also, we can know, you know, small differences between these molecules in mass, and hence, you know, hone in on our particular peak and the corresponding compound that exists for that peak. And now I'm only talking about high resolution mass spectrometry, but these instruments are typically coupled to chromatography, so you have a separation process prior to this. So you can also use other information, things like retention time. You can also fragment the mass ion peak and look at secondary fragments and so on and so forth. So one of the things that has come about in the last 10 to 15 years is confidence scales for identification by high-resolution mass spectrometry. So the thing that I described to you in the previous slide was essentially the exact mass of the compound. Let me just step back. This is called the Shemansky scale. It is a basically a confidence scale, you can look at it the other way, or uncertainty scale in identifying compounds using high resolution mass spectrometry. And one thing to note here, this is relying solely on high resolution mass spectrometry and chromatography, and a little bit of computer software use. So that's sort of the limitation here. And I'll go back to this at the end of this slide. But you know, the kind of exact mass that I showed you in the last slide, that would be a level 5 match or level 5 on the Shemansky scale as far as B confidence is concerned. Now, if you can do not only the molecular mass of the monoisotopic mass, but also do isotopic match, meaning all the variations in the carbon, the nitrogen, gives you different peaks. So you can see that pattern and you can match that as well as the most abundant mass, you get to a level four, so on and so forth. So the next one would be, you know, you can look at homologous series. So this particular scale, the Shemansky scale, has been adapted further for PFAS. So in that you look for homologous series or sort of breakdown structures for PFAS compounds. So using MS², which means the fragmented ion. Further still, you can move up to even a higher confidence scale where you have a probable structure. And there you're using things like not only, you know, some library match on an LC-MS, but also you can use experimental data. By experimental data, I mean essentially a software that's run to predict fragmentation based on, you know, the energy that's imparted to the molecule. And there are a number of these software available. The most common one is Medfrag, and people run that to see if it matches what they're getting on their instrument. And then finally, once you have a reference standard, you can have an exact match, your confirmed structure, using both the monoisotopic molecular ion mass, the isotopic variations, the fragment ions, and also the retention time on the chromatography problem. And again, to touch back on the point I made earlier, this solely relies on chromatography, high-resolution mass spectrometry. So if you have other instrumental methods like that are used for structural determination, like NMR, which will tell you adjacent elements or adjacent atoms, or FTIR, which will tell you things like functional groups, you can still have a much higher confidence in structure, not just using this scale, but, you know, additional lines of evidence as well. Okay, so this brings us to our second case study, and this case study sort of gives away the answer at the top, is associated with this discovery of the 6-PPDQ compound in environmental media, basically fresh water. Pardon me, I've jumped a few slides. Okay, 6-PPDQ, it's associated with something known as the urban runoff mortality syndrome, and I'll talk about that in a second. But it uses a combination of effect-directed analysis, which is an acute toxicity test in this case, and combined with this non-target screening or non-target analysis. So URMS was first observed in as acute mortality in coho salmon in the Pacific Northwest. And it some of the observations associated with it were that it occurs annually when the salmon return to spawn in fresh waters that are located near urbanized watersheds. And also that usually it occurs during or following rainfall runoff events. Now, there's a number of papers before this one, what this case study is based on. This is a paper by, I think it's Tian et al. By in Science in 2022, I believe. But the researchers had already discovered, or through some interesting sleuthing, that, you know, that they could induce URMS using treadwear particle leachate. Essentially, this is a complex aqueous leachate mixture of compounds produced from treadwear and tires. So in real life, this would be basically rainwater, so running off roads where there's a lot of tread deposits on the roadway. So it's leaching off some of those compounds. Now, TWPL is a very complex mixture, so there are hundreds, if not more, compounds. And it was found to cause this mortality in coho salmon. And at the start of this study, they've already exhausted all targeted analytical methods. and they were able to find a match for this the causative agent for this syndrome. So they revised so the paper sort of sets up these fractionation schemes where the mixture or the TWPL is fractionated in different via different prep columns. So it's separated on different preparatory columns. There are fractions collected, which are time dependent. And each fraction is then analyzed for toxicity. So this is the effect-directed analysis part. It was analyzed for against juvenile cohort, presumably because they are more sensitive to this compound. And if it produced mortality, it was retained. If it didn't, then it was discarded. So the fraction was discarded if it was not toxic. Excuse me. So once we know that we have the toxic fraction, these folks ran it through UHPLC HRMS, which is just ultra high performance liquid chromatography, high resolution mass spectrometry. And they pooled all the common chemical features. By chemical features, I mean essentially mass spectral peaks. And then sort of did an intersection of them and saw and tried to find out which compounds were common in all of the different fractions that or toxic fractions that they were able to obtain. So here's the same sort of setup. So I was tilted on its side. You can see that the leachate is being fed into all three preparatory columns. Now, each preparatory column has a different stationary phase, different media, and hence its interaction with the compounds in the TWPL is different. So the elution order changes of when your toxic compound elutes. So for C18, they found that let's assume this is a 10, I'm not sure what the total runtime was. Let's assume it's a 10 minutes. So each dot that you see here, white dot you see is a 1 minute fraction coming off of this column. They found that the sixth fraction in the C18 column from the C18 column and the PFP columns were toxic to the salmon, whereas the fourth fraction coming off the fennel column was toxic. They ran the UHPLC HRMS NTA, as I mentioned before, and at the intersection of all these chemical features, found that there were four common chemical features in the positive ionization mode and three in the negative ionization mode. And these are just modes in which the mass spectrometer is run. Positive meaning that it acts on a proton. The most abundant peak from those four had the mass of 29.1752. This includes the proton mass. So once now that they have something to shoot for of how to identify this particular compound, these columns can be set up in series, and a larger amount of TWPL can be put through the combined setup, and to give you like a larger mass of that toxicant. The toxicant was tested again, and its monoisotopic mass after subtracting the proton came out to 298.1681, which corresponded to the unique molecular formula for the monoisotopic mass for C18, H22, N2O2. So this would be by itself a Shemansky level 5 confidence level. Or higher. And the reason why I say higher, because Shemansky only accounts for HRMS chromatography HRMS data. So since we're doing toxicity testing, we have an additional line of evidence together with the analysis. And now once you've generated enough of this substance, they were able to get like magenta colored precipitate. It can be subjected to additional testing. So with additional testing, you have structural information using NMR, FTIR, so a tentative identification at level 3. And then finally, the confirmation was done by doing an experiment where the precursor for this compound, which is included in tire manufacturing as an antioxidant, which is called 6-PPD, was ozonated and produced the same compound that was causing the toxicity. So it's a quinone moiety of that 6-PPD compound. So that is the end of that case study. So what do you do now once you have that particular compound? We've looked at two case studies. We did the first one with tick identification by spectral library matching with the Wiley-NIST library. We looked at the non-targeted analysis example in case study two. So once we have an identity for the compound, we can simply purchase it if it's commercially available, as we did in the case for the tick compound. If it's not available, then we can have it chemically synthesized. It will be fairly expensive at this point, but as there is more demand, and this compound is being discovered in different places, you would eventually get to the point where you'll have mass production of calibration standards for this compound. And once you have that, you can move on to your standard targeted instrumental method development process, which includes accounting for QAQC effects, things like resulting from environmental matrices, sampling issues, and then a multi-lab validation where the method will be sent out to multiple labs with a sample, and various labs will fine-tune the method, and then you'll have a final validated method. Now, for this last step for developing the targeted method, I just want to reiterate that you need the calibration standard to be able to do that, to look at things like partitioning into your containers or any kind of matrix effects using recoveries and things of that nature. So all of this is prior to that, but here you need to have that compound produced in sufficient quantity so you can do targeted method development. Okay, so that brings us to the end of the individual chemical compound analysis section. And I'm just going to touch upon some of the other sections that are in the fact sheet. We started looking at PFAS as a chemical class before the recent updates to the PFAS documents from ITRC. So, I would actually direct you to that document now because it does have some of this information. So it's section 11. In that guidance, I just want to talk about a couple of them. PFAS is, as Kim mentioned to you earlier, it's a complex problem because, as we discussed, part of it is known, part of it is unknown. So there's 9,000 plus compounds. Until recently, we had analytical methods for drinking water that had 45 unique PFAS. So 537, 537.1, 533, 8327, these resulted in only 45 unique PFAS compounds of the 9,000 plus. We now have, and the slide is slightly dated. So US EPA draft method is no longer draft, it's validated, 1633. It has about 71 different PFAS analytes. But all in all, if you go to a commercial lab, there's the hard limit for the available standards for these targeted screening methods for PFAS is around 100 or less. So you can only identify and quantify about 100 different PFAS. So in addition to this, we have two methods that deal with PFAS as a class. And as I mentioned before, there's so many different PFAS, the toxicity is presumed to be similar across the chemical class for a number of them. And for these, we have the AOF method, which is the US EPA. I don't believe it's draft anymore either. It's 1621. And this essentially sorbs on organofluorine onto a sorbent and then combusts it and analyzes it by ion chromatography. So this is called combustion ion chromatography. And here you're analyzing for the fluoride ion from the mass that is sorbed onto the sorbent. This does have some sampling bias, obviously, because it is using a sorbent which may not sorb all PFAS, or it maybe sorbs all PFAS, but also sorbs other organofluorines other than PFAS. The other method is the top assay developed in David Sedlak's group at Berkeley. And this essentially is a before and after analysis. So if you've ever analyzed for trihalomethanes or trihalomethane formation potential, this is somewhat similar in the sense that you analyze your sample using a targeted method like one of these. Let's say you have 40 compounds in your targeted method, you analyze for them, and then you subject your environmental sample to excess hydroxyl radical oxidation, and then reanalyze it. So you do the oxidation, reanalyze it, and see how much more of those 40 PFAS were sort of produced from the oxidation. So it gives you an idea, or it lets you put your arms around a problem that's not obvious beyond the targeted analysis. So to see how much precursor and other PFAS load you could potentially have in your sample. The fact sheet also at the end deals with biological CECs, so pathogens. There is an existing, there is a new ITRC CEC committee focusing strictly on pathogens. This particular fact sheet, as part of the first CEC, describes all the procedures used to identify pathogens. It doesn't go into very specific procedures such as primer design for different types of pathogens, things of that nature. That is going to be dealt with in the new ITRC CEC bio committee. And then lastly, the fact sheet also deals with particulates and sort of summarizes ITRC's microplastics group's work and then moves into, methods of analysis for engineered nanoparticles. So with that, I come to the end of the analytical methods fact sheet. And I believe next, my colleague in the ITRC CEC committee, Megan Sabarik, is going to talk about risk communication as it pertains to CEC. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Farouk. I'm Megan Sabarich with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Office of Emerging Contaminants. And in this section, we're going to talk about risk perception and communication. And particularly, it's going to be how to communicate information on CECs to the public and stakeholders in a timely fashion, some risk communication basics, and some considerations and challenges to take into account when communicating CECs, and then also some lessons learned. Okay, so once your agency has set a priority level for a CEC using the process that we just discussed, it's going to be important to start using risk communication techniques with your stakeholders, whether they're internal or external of your agency. So I'll share some great resources that go in depth on risk communications in a short while, but we'll first start with some basics to make sure that we're all in the same place. The overall goal of risk communications is to educate people about the risk, to allow them to make informed decisions to protect themselves. To successfully accomplish that goal, you need to communicate the available information in a way that's accessible to the unique audience that you're trying to reach. For example, you wouldn't reach elderly adults by creating content on TikTok, nor would you reach Gen Z with messaging through the local news. The process for developing risk communication materials includes identifying and understanding your audience and stakeholders, and then engaging them in ways that are appropriate for each unique audience. It requires identifying your specific goals at different points during the communication process, understanding the concerns and perceptions of the unique audience, and then developing clear messages and pathways to reach it. You may develop the perfect message, but without understanding how to deliver the message to an audience in a way in which it's received, you might as well be shouting into the wind. Additionally, risk communications are a two-way process where you adapt messaging by listening to and learning from your audience about their concerns. Particularly with situations involving CECs, You may need to encourage decision makers in your agency to share information with the public before they feel completely comfortable doing so. While waiting until you have solid information to share is ideal, you also need to be aware of the possibility of misinformation taking hold within your audience if you aren't communicating in a timely manner. So the uncertainty surrounding CECs means messages may come from different places or sources, may urge different levels of action, and may ultimately cause confusion, distrust, and frustration in the public. Each entity that completes the prioritization process will establish a priority level that is unique to them. Differences in ecological and environmental aspects, social desire, and political commitment will impact the priority level and the actions taken to address the CEC. Additionally, entities may use different data sources or interpret data differently during the risk assessment. For example, one entity could be looking at occupational exposure, while another is looking at incidental exposure. There's also the question of what level of data is enough to develop recommendations. All of these differences will impact your messaging, which is also based on not only the scientific calculations, but the politics and level of media and community attention. Ultimately, with all these differences, an additional challenge with communicating risk from CECs could be your audience receiving different messages from different sources. So there are many definitions of risk, as well as perspectives about what is risky. To a risk assessment professional, risk is based on a mathematical function that takes into account the consequences and likelihood of something happening. As such, it's measured objectively. For example, health standards for a compound that were developed based on data from scientific studies. To a general member of the community, risk will likely be something much more ambiguous based on their experiences, fears, or other subjective factors. For example, an individual making a choice between organic or conventional produce. Effective risk communication requires understanding both objective and subjective viewpoints. For example, a community may have recently discovered PFAS in their municipal drinking water at levels below health standards. Your message could be that there is low risk to drinking the water, and here are some steps you can take to reduce exposure if you'd like to take additional actions. One additional challenge with risk communication is that each collective audience is comprised of individuals who have their own concerns that may be collectively similar for some aspects, but different for others. By talking with and learning from your audience, you will be better able to address their unique concerns collectively. So there are two approaches for communicating risk based on your overall goal. The first, precaution advocacy, encourages individuals to take action to reduce risk. Examples of precaution advocacy include campaigns to reduce smoking or encourage radon testing in homes. The second, outrage management, has a goal of calming stakeholder concern when it's disproportionate to the level of risk determined by available data. Examples could include situations where a community is concerned about potential pollution sources, but data shows the pollution has a limited impact. In these situations, it's important to be empathetic to the individual's or community's concerns, because without empathy, you may appear condescending or that you're blowing off their concerns, which could cause you to lose your audience. Regardless of which approach is needed for the specific situation, it is necessary to build trust with your audience by being honest with them, transparent about the situation, and empathetic to their concerns. Trust takes time to build, but can be easily broken. Without trust, your audience will be unreceptive to the message you're trying to communicate, which will make them less likely to follow your recommendations. So let's go deeper into precaution advocacy. As previously mentioned, this is encouraging your stakeholders or audience to take action. The message here is do something. It's important to note that early on in particular, your internal stakeholders or decision makers may be the audience here. Don't think that the only people that need risk communication skills are the organizational spokespersons and public information officers. Subject matter experts may find themselves trying to convince the organization provide additional resources to properly identify or categorize a CEC. Of course, as a CEC moves towards a higher priority and you have more information on negative human or environmental effects, you'll want to let the public know about the risk so they can take actions. The level of difficulty of your job as a risk communicator, particularly when dealing with the public, will depend on the overall situation and your audience's starting point. A useful way to visualize the starting point is with the precaution adoption process model that we can see here. So this is a series of general stages in your audience's decision-making process. Knowing roughly where they are on the list will help you to tailor your message. For example, people who are unaware of an issue or unengaged may need basic education in order to recognize the need to take action. People who have already decided to act probably need less basic education and more guidance as to how they can protect themselves. So, because I know you're going to ask, here's some suggested starting points when you're trying to get people to do things they may not otherwise be inclined to do. First, and especially if people are in stage one or two of the precaution adoption process model, they are not very interested in the issue. You need to get their attention, and even when you have it, you probably won't have it for long. Keep your message concise and interesting. Second, stay on message. Keep pushing the same short and interesting message until it sticks. Don't hesitate to appeal to emotions. I don't mean that you should rely exclusively on emotion at the expense of data, but emotions are a very powerful motivator in most people, and you can use that to your advantage. And then finally, give people things to do if it makes sense for the situation. Allow them to feel that they are doing something to take control, rather than waiting on the world to change for them. Bottom line, if it's beginning to sound like traditional advertising, that's basically what it is. So the next likely scenario you will face with CECs is when stakeholders are genuinely upset or alarmed about the situation, and your job is to reduce their concern to a level consistent with the actual hazard. If the message and precaution advocacy is do something, the message here is calm down. But the thing is, I don't recommend using the words calm down when someone's upset, because that's likely to work about as well as the last time you were in a in a disagreement. Sorry, having a little allergy issue. Gonna take a moment. Okay, sorry about that. Allergies, you know, it's that kind of season. So hopefully I can get through the rest of this without any issues. But yeah, you don't want to use the word calm down when you're dealing with the situation, because it's really going to make that other person get more upset. I don't know if you've ever been told to calm down when you've been in a disagreement, but I know that I've always ended up even more upset when that has happened to me. And you don't want to do that to your audience. So this can be a really tricky situation when your stakeholders are stressed or directing their anger about the situation at you. They have more difficulty processing the information, particularly when it's made up of large complex words like per and polyfluoroalkyl substances. They may convince themselves that the sky is falling and may get defensive when you try to convince them otherwise. So it can be really tricky to navigate. Okay, so what are some strategies to handle the inevitable public outrage when a CEC turns up in the news? First, you want to stake out the middle. And what I mean by that is to acknowledge that the other side has a point, even if they're insisting on the worst case interpretation, and that's the only interpretation. So staking out the middle does a couple of things for you. First, you're validating by your audience by letting them know they are not foolish because of their concerns. You're not validating their interpretation, but you are validating them as an individual and that they have understandable concerns. After all, you want to start where your audience is and not where you would prefer them to be. So, second, taking an extreme, everything is perfectly fine, position will inevitably lose. Humans evolved to be cautious, and people who assumed the saber-toothed tiger wanted to eat them and acted accordingly survived. And those who thought the little kitty just wanted to play didn't. Similarly, in a situation between there's massive danger versus there's zero danger, massive danger is going to win every time. In massive danger versus a little bit of danger, a little bit of danger has a chance. So then, second, acknowledge problems. In terms of CECs, this is often going to be the uncertainty involved. It's true that people don't like uncertainty, but if you start out by pointing out that things are very likely to change and that the information you have now is the best available, changing your advice or even your position down the road will not reflect this badly on you as the messenger. Changing your position with no forewarning, or worse, no acknowledgement that you ever had a different position, will almost certainly lead your audience to conclude that you are not to be trusted. If your job as a risk communicator is to try to change minds, being considered untrustworthy by your audience is going to make that job that much harder. Okay, so while each situation will have different challenges, here are some best practices to keep in mind when communicating CECs. Since each situation is different, tailor your message to your communication goal as well as to the specific audience you're trying to reach. Your message and process for educating people about a lower risk situation will be different than the message and process used if you're urging immediate actions. Your message and goals will likely change throughout the CEC life cycle as well. There are great resources available for risk communication that will help you identify very specific audiences and hone the message you want to communicate to that audience, and I'll be sharing those very soon. So, by their very nature, emerging contaminants will have changing information that needs to be communicated. And as such, you'll want to update your audience as frequently as possible with transparent messaging to avoid the impression that you're hiding information. People will seek answers to their questions. If you aren't providing trusted information, others will fill that void. Can you trust that the information being provided by other sources is accurate? And then in changing situations, it can be difficult to provide consistent and understandable messaging. The communicator may be concerned about looking indecisive and incompetent when presenting changing information, and may be tempted to state information as fact rather than acknowledging the uncertainty of the situation. However, the communicator's credibility, and by extension, the organization's credibility, can be damaged tremendously by presenting something as fact when the data isn't so clear. Instead, acknowledge the uncertainty in a confident manner, share what you know, where information and gaps exist, and when more information can be expected. Then finally, it's critical to be honest about the situation. When there's a high risk to the individual, it may be tempting to omit information, overstate the available information, or lie to influence people to make choices that you feel are correct. After all, you're doing it to protect the public, right? But the potential costs to your organization's credibility are too high and could easily end up hurting your overall goal of protecting the public from a CEC. Once trust is lost, it's difficult to regain. So here are four resources that will take you in depth into risk communications. If you just Google any of these terms, you'll be able to track those down on the internet. And these resources will each help you get started with identification of your goals and specific audiences, developing messages to reach those identified goals and audiences, and considerations to take during communication planning. And with that, I've made it through the rest of my presentation. And now I'll turn it over to Devin for any follow-up questions that we have.
All right, thank you very much, Megan. Let me just stop remote control here. Okie dokie. So, as Megan mentioned, this is our last Q&A section of our training, and then the training will be wrapped up, and I will wish you all a wonderful afternoon. Just before we jump into the Q&A, I'm going to just give our few logistical wrap-up notes just to give some more time for some questions to come in, and then we will jump into that. So again, for those interested in certificates of completion, they are available on the training page that brought you here today on Cluin under the feedback form. We would love to hear back from you today. So even if you're not interested in a certificate of completion, please be sure to fill out the feedback form just to let us know how the training course went today. And to help with some, any future topics of training needs. If you would like to download the slides for later, they are also available on the Cluin training page as well. So with that, I'm going to look to our Q&A pod and we will jump into our final Q&A. So our first question for our trainers, in an investigation of groundwater and soil, there is a paradigm that performs an analysis of VOCs, EPA method 8260D, or SVOCs, and assumes that all compounds that present some type of risk have been identified. Is the CEC identification framework intended to change this approach?
So let me take a stab at this because I'm not particularly, I don't know for sure what the question is honing in on, if it's a risk question or something else. But typically 8260D, 8270E, these are targeted analytical methods. So these have long lists of target analytes. They have, and they're validated. You can both quantify and identify these compounds on the target analyte list. So these compounds wouldn't be considered CEC on these lists. So that's one thing. The changes to the latest version of these methods, I think the target analyte list has been expanded. There are different procedures for identification, at low levels like SIM, so selective ion monitoring. But generally, all of this is for known compounds and not necessarily for contaminants of emerging concerns. So I hope that answers it. If you have any additional question, please type it in so we can follow up with that. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Farouk. And yes, if you need any more clarification, please just let us know to the person that asked that. Our next question, which is for Farouk based on your section. On slide number 60, what was the criteria used for fractionations one and two? That was the first question, and I will pause with that first so that you can answer it. And if you need to go back to slide 60, just let me know. I can do
that. I was muted, sorry. 60 and 61 are basically the same slide. 60 is a more simplified version of 61, which basically is dividing up the process into the three steps, which is the mixture simplification, effect-directed analysis, and non-target analysis. 61 goes into the specific fractionation column used or method used, like C18, PFP, and phenol, and looks at how those chemical features, once you have the HRMS data, how they were pooled, and the common ones were sort of extracted out of that pooling. So they're essentially the same slide. So I hope that simplifies things for you.
All right, thank you. So, did you answer both parts of that question for?
No, I didn't. You didn't read out the second.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. So the second part is for slide 61, did you consider any synergistic effects?
So it's not my work, first of all, let me say that it's excellent work. But one of the critiques for that particular paper is that there are other things that can cause this sort of effect as well. including, other TWPL, the Tredware particle leachates. So that's one of the criticisms of that study. But this particular compound that they isolated for sure causes this sort of effect. Now, this was a relatively easy toxicity assay to run. As for a lot of environmental contaminants, we generally don't have acute responses, but rather more chronic effects over a long period of time. So those become difficult to do just with a toxicity test. In this case, you can sort of hone in on the particular toxicant using a short-term toxicity test. But for those compounds, you have to use other approaches. So there are different chemistry-driven approaches and also spatial analysis approaches that are available in literature, where you look at substances that have long-term or chronic effects.
All right, thank you, Farouk. All right, our next question. Since our last section talking about risk perception brought up the use of social media, can you talk a little bit about how to best combat disinformation?
Yeah, so you're not going to be able to control what other people or organizations, what information they're putting out into the public's awareness. So you really want to focus on what information you're putting out and the relationship that you're building with your audience. So it really is getting out and talking with your audience and providing them with the information that you know is the best available, and just really keeping to that message, and just continuing to repeat it and letting them know when you might have more information, and acknowledging where those gaps are or that it's changing information, and really working to build that relationship so that you are a trusted person, or a trusted entity that these groups and individuals can turn to for accurate information.
All right. Thank you, Megan. So that concludes our Q&A session for our CEC webinar today. I'd just like to end on one final logistic note, which is if you would like any clarification on any questions or answers provided today, feel free to get in touch with us at ITRC at itrcweb.org, or feel free to get in touch with our trainers directly. Their information is listed on the training page that brought you here today. I did put the link to the training page in the chat for everybody to follow, as that is where the feedback form is as well. We do have actually one quick clarification question that just came in, Farouk, if you want to, if we want to
Sure.
answer based on the
Yeah,
one that
so
you.
I mean, this goes back to the case study one. So you should look through those slides, and essentially, you have these methods 8260 and 8270 temperature program or solvent for the GC. So within that program, you can still elute compounds that are not on that target analyte list. So very similar to case study one, where you got the chlorotrifluorotoluene that wasn't on the old 8270 list. I haven't checked if it's on there now. So very similar to that, if it does elute as a separate peak, you will have a spectrum for it when you're running full scan. And from that, if you can locate it in some sort of a general reference library, then you will have an idea of what that compound is. And again, that's more likely to occur for GCMS, for compounds that can be analyzed by GCMS, less likely for LC-MS-based methods. I hope that helps.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Farouk, for the follow-up on that. And thank you. I'd just like to say thank you to our attendees for joining us today, and a big thank you to our trainers for developing this course and supporting it. So with that, I would just like to wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day, and hopefully we will see you in a future ITRC training course. Thanks so much.